come up. We're ready to roll. Is Chad coming up there with you too? He shook his head no.
He'll be up in a minute. Is that me or? Yeah, that's the one. Just waiting for the PowerPoint. All right, well, good morning, and thanks for having us here. The work that I'm going to present today with Chad Demarest is a follow-up on some analysis that the social sciences branch has done for fishing year 2011 in the groundfish fishery on performance of that fishery. We are now starting work on fishing year 2012. We just got the data for that. But this particular piece focuses on fishing year 2011 because it takes some time to work through some of this ACE trading data. So in particular, we're trying to build in as many costs into our estimates of financial performance, and in particular, the cost of purchasing ACE is a new cost under sector management, as you're all aware of, and we're trying to understand what that represents to various components of the fleet. Next slide, please. So in terms of some background, the net revenue estimates in the 2011 report on groundfish did not account for any of the ACE or PSC trading. I'm just going to refer to that in general as quota. In that report, the only information we had was about the trades between sectors. But subsequent to that report, sectors provide additional details on both between and within sector trades in their reports to the fishery service that they provided at the end of the fishing year. So these new data are discussed in this new report that should be in your packet and will eventually come out as a center reference document. I'll take comments from this presentation and incorporate that into the final version. So we'll happy to hear your thoughts on it. But the new data that was provided did not have sufficient detail to adjust the net revenue estimates in the original groundfish report, and I'll talk briefly about why that is and how it relates to net revenue. So instead, we needed to simulate the market for trading quota to be able to say in a little more detail how the ACE trading affects those net revenues by the different components of the fleet. There's a couple of figures that I want to make that will be a little hard to keep track of, and I'm going to explain a few things. I'm going to first focus on some of the information in the report that just provides information on what happened in the market, what happened between sectors that traded quota and what happened within sectors. And then I'll move on to the simulation piece. But one of the things I want to make clear, I'm not going to show all of the figures here on that reported information, but one of the things, there's only two graphs in the report that show the actual volume of quota that's traded between and within sectors. The rest of the report is all based on the net position. And what I mean by that is if we look at the slide that's up, the reported gross trades for between sector trading was $7.8 million worth of quota that was traded. And within sectors, there was $18.5 million worth of quota that moved around among the members. That adds up to $16.3 million. When you net that out, when you look at what the net result is, the total amount that was traded is $10.9 million. So, you know, I want to make sure you understand what the difference is between that 16.3 and the 10.9, and I'll just illustrate that with an example. Here, if we just think of, we can think of this as within an individual sector. There are three fishermen, and Fisherman A sells $1,000 worth of quota to Fisherman B, who might sell $500 worth of some other quota to Fisherman C. Well, you know, you can see that there's this flow of quota that revolves around these three fishermen. Well, if you add up those movements between each fisherman, that adds up to $3,000. And that's what I'm referring to as sort of the gross value of trade that is moved around. So in the reported data that we got from sectors, that was a total of $16.3 million. When you actually go in and calculate the net difference, and here the example would be, you know, Fisherman A paid Fisherman C $1,500 for that quota that he purchased, but also received $1,000 from Fisherman B for the quota that he sold. So if you look at each individual fisherman, the net cost for Fisherman A was $500. The net cost for Fisherman B was $500, and the net revenue for Fisherman C was $500. So I just want to make that point clear that the majority of this report that I'm going to be talking about is talking about these net positions. It's not the total volume of trade. And this one graph here shows what the final, and it's a little hard to see here, apologize for that, shows the final net position by sector. So, for example, the fixed gear sector is all the way on the left there. If you add up all of the net lessors of quota, those are members who leased out fish and received revenue. There was about, that netted out to about a $2 million income to those fishermen. It was about $1 million. If you add up all the net lessees, the people who leased in fish, they had a cost of $1 million. So the green bar on each of these sectors shows the final net position of each sector. It just gives you a sense of which sectors were net lessors and net lessees of quota. So now I'm going to switch to the simulation results. But first I want to talk a little bit about, why we had to simulate the market in the first place. The net revenues in the fishing year 2011 groundfish report were based on vessel characteristics. We looked at gear type, vessel size, length of trip, all sorts of characteristics of the vessel to estimate what their net revenue was. The data that we got from sectors on their trade was at the sector member level. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's how the market functions. It's members of the sector that trade within their own sector or between sectors. The problem for linking that back to net revenue is two things. One, some of the sectors did not provide us the information to link those vessel identifiers to their member identification number. So, for some of them that was a problem, but the larger issue is, if there's a sector member that owns, say, three vessels, we would only have the information, they'd only be able to report the information on, what that owner, when he traded with another member in a sector or another sector, what that trade was for those that set of vessels that he has PSC on. So, how then do you then interpret, how that PSC might have come off those individual vessels is we just don't have actual data on that. So that's why we had to simulate this trading at the vessel level. So the end result, after working through all the data, we could only associate about $5 million of trades with individual vessels. So if the example of a single owner of a single vessel, that wasn't a problem. We could, and if we had the information to link up the MRI number with the sector member ID, then we could associate those vessel characteristics with that trade. And then for some of the other reasons that we didn't have full data set, we could only link up about $5 million of the $10 million of actual trading that went on. So, and that wasn't a representative enough sample for us, so we decided that we needed to simulate the trading. So the process for simulating the trading, on the quota cost side, we have information on catch by vessel. We know what their PSC is. So we knew if we looked at the data that if the catch exceeded the PSC, that vessel needed to purchase quota in order to cover that fish that was caught or discarded. It was a total catch that we were looking at. And so we estimated the value of that quota to be that requirement times a quota price, which was from work that Chad did in the ground fish report. He used a model that looked at the trading data and estimated prices for there was an annual price for each stock that was traded. That is a limitation of the study. It does assume one price for the whole year. We didn't have enough information to do a trade by trade or month by month or week by week prices. So we are using these annual level prices. Anyway, the end result of looking at how catch compared to the value of PSC that was initially allocated to each vessel, the result was there was $5.2 million worth of quota that needed to be purchased to cover that catch that exceeded the allocation. On the other side of the market, the simulation of the revenue followed three basic steps, and we had to make some assumptions here. Certainly, I'm sure you can find examples that fit this set of assumptions and some that don't, but this is sort of the best we could do with what we understood about how this market operated. But the first step is to look at these groupings of what we're calling vessel affiliations, and the example could be one owner that has three vessels or two partners who own together five vessels. We assume that the trading of quota would occur within those vessel affiliations first. And the process that we used was to rank within those vessel affiliations by vessel length first and by the amount of quota that was available to be sold. And the reasoning for that is we understand that a lot of these, for example, less than 30-foot boats, a lot of them are skiffs that have PSC associated with it, that those would be most likely to sell their quota to other vessels. So we ranked the vessels in that order, went through the simulation based on who needed the quota. So we follow that step. So the quota is sold in that order until that need is met. And then once that's satisfied, it moves on to step two, which is the trading within the sector. And the assumption there is that all else equal, sector members are probably more likely to sell within their sector first than selling outside the sector because of some of the rules that sectors have about right of first refusal and charging fees for selling outside the sector. So we made that assumption that, again, the order of the trading would occur first by vessel size. And here we include CPH vessels. And we would have preferred to have permits in CPH be part of the within affiliation trading, but we're not able to link those permits up to the definitions of vessel affiliations. Within sectors, we assume that a quota would first be bought by CPH permits and then by the smaller vessels and moving up through the larger vessels and according to the amount of quota that was available to sell. And then lastly, step three was to simulate what the between sector trading would be, and that was purely based on, at that point after the internal trading was done, how that would progress based on the amount that was available to sell and what was left to be what was left of the requirements. So in the end, the within sector trading simulation and the between sector trading simulation added up to the $10.8 million. If we refer back to my example where I was talking about net versus gross, the reported quota trading by sectors added up to 10.9. So our simulation came close to the $10.9 million. We're making the assumption here that sectors would not have reported in their reports the within vessel affiliation trades. So the rest of the results will just focus on this $10.8 million. And essentially that 4.4 that probably occurred within vessel affiliations is we're looking at that as more of a paper transaction. If I'm a single owner and I have three boats and I'm transferring some PSC from one vessel to another, that's sort of a paper transaction, and we're not including that in these cost estimates. So here's some results from the simulation, and this just breaks down the vessels that needed to buy ACE by vessel size and by stock. And the bottom line here is, it's the other way around. It's the vessels that spent money to buy quota. And you can see here the greater than 75 foot length category was definitely a purchaser of ACE. And again, a little hard to see on the graph, but this will be in the report. You can kind of see how this breaks out. We'll be discussing the different components of the fleet and how this all shakes out later, and Chad will be focusing a lot on that in his presentation. The next graph shows the breakdown by home port state and stock. A lot of activity in Massachusetts, obviously. This next slide is the simulation results on the vessels that received revenue from quota trades. And again, this is by length class and by stock. And again, the end result of the simulation here is that larger vessels are purchasing ACE from the smaller vessels. And again, this is by home port state and stock. So here I just want to show, this is eventually what we were trying to get to. There are some tables in the 2011 report that reported net revenue, and as I mentioned, they did not include ACE trading in that. So we took the information in that table and then modified it to show the impact of quota trading. And so the first column here shows the net revenue that was estimated, and then by each of these vessel categories, the average cost of quota purchased and the average revenue received from quota sales, and then we modified the net revenue estimates by those figures. So for example, the 50 to 75 foot length class, the net revenue drops from about $249,000 to $229,000, so it was a $20,000 drop on average for vessels in that size category when you account for the quota that they needed to purchase. Now, I know these are averages. I do show standard deviations on this to give you a sense of the swing in these figures. And on net, for the two larger size categories, it's about an 8% drop in their net revenue. Again, I want to make really clear that there can be some wide variation on both ends of that. It could be a lot larger than 8% or smaller than 8%. And again, Chad's going to go through some of the breakdown by different categories of vessels to give you a sense of that difference. These last two slides then show if you aggregate up across all of these vessel categories, what's happened on aggregate. This table shows it by vessel size category, and then the last table shows it by home port state. So, happy to take some questions about the details of that. Before I do that, though, I do want to say that while we did have to simulate the market, the data that we did receive from sectors was extremely helpful, and we did use the actual reported data to calibrate the simulation. But with the more complexities that arise in the evolution of how sector management is changing over time, we might not be able to continue to simulate. Some of these assumptions might be just too simple for what's actually happening in the market. So, I do want to stress that it is important that we continue to receive good information from sectors on their trading, and ideally we would use, if we could, the actual data to adjust net revenues and to work it into fuller estimates of profitability. The main purpose of this presentation was to give a sense of how these net revenue figures have changed, but also just to show what we can do with this type of information and really encourage sectors to continue to provide it. So I can take some questions, and then Chad will come up and get into some more detail about the breakdown by category.
Thank you for that presentation, Drew. Terry Alexander?
Yeah, could you go to slide 7? Is that 7? The one before that, I think. Sorry.
What's that?
The one before that.
One before that. Okay.
Sorry. I thought it was 7. Okay. So, could you explain again how you calculated whether or not a guy was a net leaser? Say I had 10,000 pounds of cod. Based on my original permit with that, with that boat,
right.
But I also owned, three or four other permits that had scattering batches of cod. Did I hear you right in saying that you would call me a net leaser if I leased in more than I caught, even though I actually owned
the. All right. Well, there's two things going on there. In your example, if you're just moving quota around between your vessels, we actually, we simulate that, but we kind of then set those transactions aside, so that wouldn't factor in. But after doing all the internal redistribution, if you sold $1,000 worth of quota to somebody else, but then a month later you bought $500 worth. On net, you sold 500. So
yep.
That's what I meant by net versus gross.
Okay. And the you were given reports constantly. Our sector manager reports constantly on every trade that's made internally inside of our sector. It's unless it's your own fish that you're taking.
Right.
And we always have to even if he's not involved in the trade, he needs to know what we paid to report to NIMS, what we're paying for that. And you guys don't get that from every sector, or is that?
Well, we do have information on the trades from every sector, between and within. The problem was that some of the sectors just said sector member A sold fish to sector member B. but we don't know who A and B was, where, while other sectors actually said the MRIs that are associated with sector member A.
Anyone else? Dave Gaisel.
Thank you. This has been very useful. On figure six, just so I can make sure that I understand this correctly, basically the add up the blue bar and the red bar and which way the green bar goes is net is on a sector basis, whether it's a loss or a gain, correct?
Right, right. So in a sense, the red and the blue bars are net lessors, net lessees, but then presenting this at the sector level is sort of another level of net, you know. So it's a net within a net.
Okay, so based on this, you could say the fixed gear sector is a big net revenue winner from leasing, whereas sector two is a big net revenue loser.
That's correct, right?
Mm-hmm. And this is on a sector basis, so within a sector, and I'll use my own, which is sector 12, which has very few boats in it. In this case, probably the guy who's the red is me, and the guy who's the blue is everybody else, and the net for the sector is a small loss, but for the guy who had to lease the fish, it's a big loss. And how are we going to get at that? How, you know, basically all these, the only one who considers these to be on a sector basis is the United States government. Everybody else thinks they're individual quotas. So how are we going to get at this on an individual basis?
Well, I mean, that's what the simulation does. It is on an individual vessel basis. I've just presented this figure just to give a sense of what's happening at the sector level. But the actual simulation is on a vessel level. Or,
yeah. Okay, so at some point, I mean, I know it says by vessel size classes there's averages there, but at some point will you get this to the point where you could say, you know, vessel A lost $30,000 leasing fish, vessel B made 15, or is it never going to be that?
Yeah, no, average? And actually that's what Chad's going to talk about next, is some of those details.
Tom Dempsey.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, and thanks, Drew. I thought this was great. I'm looking at slide 14. I'm trying to understand the takeaways. It seems like I might be missing something crucial in the sort of last takeaway slide. Could you walk me through, you know, this is net quota revenue exclusively, right? So just the net costs and net revenue from quota acquisitions or quota leasing.
Right.
So I guess this may be an obvious question, but this doesn't include the net revenue or any change in revenue associated with actually acquiring constraining stocks and leveraging that quota investment or quota expenditure into increased opportunities for fishing, right?
I'm not sure I'm following the question. I mean,
so if I say I lay out a certain amount of money for Georgia's Bank Yellowtail Flounder,
mm-hmm.
I can actually leverage additional fishing opportunities for quotas that I have out of that investment in that leased fish.
Right.
We're not, this doesn't include any sort of actual harvesting increase or decrease relative to the
right
quota leasing activity, right?
Right. If I understand your question, I think, yeah, what it doesn't consider is right, what you would not have been able to catch maybe in other species because, you know, say you needed the cod for a bycatch, and in order to get what else you were targeting for, you needed to purchase some cod. It doesn't calculate in what that value you gain from going after that other thing that you weren't able to get with the cod. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, and recognizing that's
yeah.
pretty complicated, and
right.
but that is, in essence, what people are... what's driving this lease market, whether it's hake, Georgia's
right.
Bank Yellowtail, blackbacks. Mm-hmm. And people are looking at those leased opportunities primarily not only for targeted stocks, but for bycatch stocks to leverage additional opportunities.
Right.
And if we're not at least trying to include that analysis and those impacts, then I think we're going to have a skewed perspective on the leasing market and the market overall. Because I think, at least in some of these cases, what jumps off the page is, you know, people are looking at acquiring, say, White Hake to go out and prosecute or harvest Pollock and get at their quota. I don't know how that could be factored in here, but I think it...
Yeah, no, that's a very important point, and that's something we'll need to look at. But, yeah, that's not part of this, but, yeah.
So, absent that, could you walk me through just a line, say, you know, the less than 30 and the 30 to 50 here on slide 14? So, I just want to make sure I get the takeaway. So, in net, no harvesting activities, no ex-vessel dock prices included, just in net quota... market activities, the less than 30 foot segment of the fleet in net is, what is that, 6,800% positive?
Right. So it's actually a little easier to talk about the 30 to 50 because, you know, the less than 30 was such an inactive vessel. So if we look to the 30 to 50, the first column is the approximately $15 million of net revenue, and that's the original estimate of the gross revenue they receive from selling fish minus, you know, fuel, oil, ice, those kind of costs. So a total of $15 million. That category of vessels then had to go out and purchase an additional, you know, $2.7 million of quota, but they then also sold $1.8 million. So that 14, you know, $14.5 million original figure then drops to 13.6 because of that. You know, on net, they purchased more than they got revenue for.
I will just follow up and say thanks for that. I understand that better. I do think it's crucially important that we also identify the increased harvest and revenue opportunities leveraged by quota acquisitions, because I think that's going to change the picture.
I'm going to take Dr. Pierce, and then we're going to move on to get Chad's presentation and get some more questions.
Yeah, thanks. Very helpful. From the tables that you provided, obviously the information is based on averages and reported as averages and reported as aggregate information, so that's useful, but doesn't get me where I really need to go, and David actually touched on my concern as to individual effects on individuals and how they stand in the leasing market. Specifically, let's go back to table 13, slide 13. This is kind of a follow-up to what Tom just said. But number 13 is the one that catches my attention, because looking at the 30-foot to less than 50-foot vessel length and then the average net revenue per vessel, I see $60,000 or so, $63,000, but the standard deviation is quite large, $82,000. So that suggests to me that there are likely very many vessels in the 30-foot to 50-foot category that had very little revenue, maybe were operating at a loss. Because, again, we're looking at an average net of $63,000, but that range is huge. So I really would like to see the individual situations, because that's what it's all about. We're talking about individual operators and how they are surviving or not. Are they viable or not? And I can see the same thing with the 50-foot to less than 75-foot category, since $248,000, but then the standard deviation is very large, so there are likely, and I know this to be true from the NOAA Fisheries, Division of Marine Fisheries break-even report a few years ago, there are many vessel owners in that category that are having a very difficult time. Over 50% back in 2010 were not breaking even. So I always go back to that particular report. So many fishermen and many vessel classes were not breaking even back then, and the situation is likely even worse now in light of the ACL. So am I correct in my interpretation of that particular table that we really don't get a good feel for the vessels, all the vessels within this particular vessel category, because we're using aggregate or average information? with large standard deviations.
Right. No, you're entirely correct, and that's a great lead into to Chad's presentation. You know, some of this, you know, for the brevity of a presentation like this to give an overview, bounded by the other end of the extreme, you know, we have, you know, we can't report individual vessel data, but yeah, Chad will provide some more details on how that breaks out by different classes of vessels.
Good, thank you. Then one other point. This is to the report yourself, the report you provided. In your conclusion on the last page, you say, you note how the analysis is complicated and how it could become even more complicated if certain things happen, if the industry changes in some way, if it adapts and modifies the way it does business. But the sentence that caught my attention was, if there are improvements in how quota trades are reported, it may not be necessary to simulate trades. I would rather get away from simulations, which are good and useful, but I want to see how it's really happening. So what have you stated in this report, and I've just missed it, or maybe you said it during your presentation, what improvements are necessary in how quota trades are reported so that you and your staff would be able to give us these sorts of analyses that are real as opposed to simulations?
Well, the main thing would be if, you know, if we had 100% participation in sectors that, you know, identify the MRIs with their sector members when they report their trades. That, you know, I think we're about 75% now. So if we could get 100% of that, that would be a huge help. And not till really doing this report to really understand, you know, think long and hard about the within vessel affiliation trades. I think if we were able to get some sense, now I know I'm not talking about the same level of reporting, but maybe some better sense about what those affiliations are and what kind of internal transfers might be happening there, that would be helpful as well.
Thank you, Drew. Chad?
Y'all are all trying to get ahead of ourselves here. So I'm going to try to address both Tom and Dr. Pierce's comments to the extent that we can by looking at what the impact of leasing is more at the vessel level. So taking the data that Drew and I put together and the simulation work that Drew did and looking at how that actually shakes out for fishing year 2011. So as Drew so eloquently stated, we came out with about a net of $10.8 million worth of quota trading. And that's, again, an estimate based on a single price. And of course, that's not accurate, right? The price of ACE leases changes throughout the year, in sometimes in one way and sometimes in another way. You know, typically it's a little bit high at the beginning of the year and then drops out at the end. This past year it was pretty low for most of the last part of the year. And so it's inaccurate and potentially misleading to put one price on all of the ACE trades, because the way that the trades happen throughout the year isn't evenly spaced either. So if we could getting to Dave's question to Drew, the better data we can get on price trends throughout the year for ACE trading, the better we'll be able to provide vessel-level impacts back to the public and the council. So that's another area that we're working with the RO and working with the industry and everybody, I think, is on the same page in trying to improve the granularity of these data. And I think we're going to get there. I think that the sector annual reports that are going to come in for 2012 are going to have better data than that came in for 2011. And I think that 2013 will be even better. So we are definitely on the way towards making big improvements in these sorts of data. Back up a little bit and talk about the framework for leasing within the industry. And Tom had already kind of talked about this, but quota leases are transfers between industry participants. When there's lease fees, when sectors charge for either leasing in or leasing out quota from other sectors, that is a true cost. But everything else is a transfer within the industry. Money's flowing from one place to another. the ability to lease increases revenues for both the people that choose to lease out and the people that choose to lease in. If the market's competitive, everybody gains from trade. That's kind of a fundamental notion of economics. Trade is always a good thing, as long as it's a competitive market. The price paid for leasing in quota is equal to the price that somebody is foregoing when they choose to convert that quota into landings. If you're a fisherman and you go out and catch 1,000 pounds or burn 1,000 pounds of ace, you could have leased that ace out. So you have to have a profit that's above what you would have made had you not gone fishing and chosen to lease that fish out. So the cost of leasing in fish is the exact same as the cost of failing to lease out fish. And hopefully that opportunity cost makes a little bit of sense. And then the largest true cost from leasing, from the market that we have for leasing both within sectors and between sectors, is probably the cost associated with the market not adequately matching buyers and sellers from the trades that don't happen. From instances where people could have been made better off if they were able to obtain the quota that they needed, and they didn't because they didn't know where it was or they couldn't find the right price. So those are avenues that I think we're working on trying to improve information flows and kind of price discovery so that we can reduce those costs that are associated with the quota market. So typically when we talk about vessel level impacts, I've always broken it down by home port state, principal port state, port level, gear type or vessel size class. But as Dr. Pierce noted in the last presentation, there's high standard deviations when you do that. And after the beatings that I've gotten from Dr. Pierce over the last couple of council meetings on reporting vessel level impacts, I've been trying for the last 6 months to kind of wrap my head around how we can make Dr. Pierce happy on this without reporting private data. And I think part of the problem is that there's a lot of heterogeneity, even at the size class or the gear type level. People fish in different ways and have much different business models. And without reporting an individual fishing vessel's behavior and performance, which obviously we can't do, it took me a long time to figure out a way to try to come up with something that would address the underlying question, which is, what's the impact at the vessel level? So what I ended up doing was a kind of a cluster analysis on all of the boats that were actively fishing. And I used what I thought were pretty sensible. I tried millions of different variables, but I ended up coming up with clusters that are based on the pounds of ground fish and the pounds of non-ground fish that the vessel landed, the number of crew, the trip duration, and the gear. And they cluster out pretty distinctly. That's what that little picture is, with all the purple squares and the green X's and the red plus marks in the circles. That's a two-dimensional representation of five different variables, but in any case, the clusters are actually pretty distinct and unique, and you get these four different clusters. You get these repeatable modes of fishing, and they carry throughout the year. I did the same analysis from 2007 through 2012, although I'm only using the 2011 clusters here, and it's amazing how similar these different clusters are across the years. So first I'm going to talk about what the clusters look like, and then I'm going to talk about the vessel level impacts of leasing by using these different clusters as a representative fishing vessel. So the first cluster, Cluster A, there's 21 boats in 2011 that met this kind of cluster definition. A representative fishing vessel would be a dragger from either Maine or Massachusetts. They'd be 80 feet long, about 800 horsepower, making 6-day trips with 4 to 5 crew. They do 1 million-plus pounds of fish per year. 87% of that is ground fish. About 1.5 million per year gross revenues. These are big boats, high horsepower, long trips, lots of crew. The next cluster, 107 vessels, so this is about a quarter of the fleet, are big draggers from all different ports, Maine, Mass, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, North Carolina, all different home ports. 70 feet long, significantly lower horsepower vessels, but still taking 5-day trips, 3 to 4 crew, doing a lot less in volume, 400 to 500,000 pounds of fish per year, but 70% ground fish, 30% non-ground fish, doing about $500,000 a year in gross revenues. So that would be the representative fishing vessel from this cluster. Next cluster, only 15 vessels, almost entirely gill netters, Mass, Rhode Island home ports, 45 feet, pretty low horsepower, short trips, 3 crew, but a lot of volume, 900,000 pounds of fish per year, but very little ground fish, doing about $300,000 a year in gross revenues. And then the bulk of the fleet, 229 vessels fitting this cluster definition, are gillnetters and draggers from throughout the range, smaller boats, smaller horsepower, short trips to crew, and much less volume, 110,000 pounds of fish per year, 50% ground fish, 50% non-ground fish, $125,000 per year in gross revenue. So that's a typical vessel that would fit this. And again, these clusters were very interestingly consistent across the years from 2007 to 2012. When you break out the clusters and then look at the kind of the average and standard deviations throughout the years, it was remarkable how similar these types of fishing operations existed throughout the years. So I also put in three non-fishing clusters because one of the interesting things is the ability to say who's also making money from leasing, who's not fishing. That's what we've never been able to, that's a question we've never been able to answer before Drew was able to do the simulation work. We've known that there's permits that are sitting idle and people are leasing out the fish, but when we talk about how many boats are involved in the fishery, we always just talk about the vessels that are landing fish. You know, that number has gone down from 480 to 390 over the last 3 years or whatever, but there's a number of MRIs that are leasing out fish, making money, generating revenue from transfers within the industry, but not actively landing fish. And we didn't have a good picture on what that side of the industry was looking like until now. So we've got the state-run permit banks. Again, this is 2011, so the state-run permit banks weren't all fully functioning. We've got 8 permits that are there. Private permit banks or NGO owners, 39 permits in 2011. And then privately owned permits, not fishing, generating revenues from leasing. These are individual ownership group permits that are owned by ownership groups that did not catch fish. So these are not fishermen's extra permits, active fishermen's extra permits. These are 345 permits that were owned by people that did not catch any fish in 2011. That means 764 permits belonging to unique ownership groups generated revenue from either fishing or leasing in 2011. You always hope these things are going to be bigger on the slide than they really are. So what we've got here on the left side are the number of vessels in each of the clusters that either generated revenues from leasing fish and fishing, that's the both column, from fishing only or from leasing only. And then the right-hand side is that in percentage terms. So, I mean, what you're seeing is that, you know, most of the vessels in the active fishing, the four active fishing clusters, generated revenue from both leasing and fishing, except in that 229 vessels in the cluster D, 102 of those were fishing only. They didn't lease out. They didn't generate revenue from leasing out fish, which is kind of interesting. The money generated from fishing activities for the lease only, that must be data artifacts, because I'm not sure how you could, if you have a permit in CPH, I'm not sure how that permit could generate fishing revenues. So I can't really explain the one or two vessels that generated money from fishing that were in permit banks. But anyway. So this next slide is the mean revenue from leasing quota and then the mean cost of leasing quota in by those different clusters. So by those representative fishing units, fishing vessel units. And so for the largest boats, you know, they generated about $6,000 per vessel across those 21 vessels from leasing quota out. And their quota cost, the cost of leasing quota in, was $127,000 on average across those boats. And that represents about 8% of their gross revenue. Now, that's obviously a bit of an artificial ratio because when you lease, you're obtaining greater revenues than you would have obtained without leasing. So that 8% is really a very artificial notion. It's not a real ratio and shouldn't interpret too much, but it is interesting to note. That C cluster, that primarily non-ground fish vessel cluster, you know, they were net lessors. They leased out. And the other three clusters were kind of net leasing in. think I might have got my lessor, lessee thing straight. I don't think I'll ever get that straight in my head. So this is a slide that I included, not to really talk about here, but I blew it up in the handout. The very last page of the handout blows this slide up so that you can see. This is the descriptive statistics for each of those clusters. And I include that just because I think people are going to be interested, not because I have anything insightful to say about it right now. Tracing quota back to the MRI level, as Drew said, was an inexact science for this exercise. I think that we're going to get much better data for 2012 when the annual reports come in. I think that's August 1st. And I think we'll be able to do an even better job of this next year. To the extent that we can come up with reporting mechanisms that get us either in a more granular data at the owner ID MRI level or more granular in time, maybe quarterly reporting or something crazy like that, and we're not trying to increase the burden on sector managers for reporting. There's plenty of burdens already. But to the extent that we can get better data, we'll be able to provide better estimates. 345 permit holders outside of permit banks generated revenues from leasing and not from fishing. The mean of that was $18,000 per permit. There's a high standard deviation on that. Some permits, you know, had a lot of PSC, got a big chunk of change for leasing it all out in one, you know, bulk chunk. And then some permits had very little PSC and still chose to lease it out. So, but the mean was $18,000 per permit in FY 2011. And then, as I said already, the comparison of gross revenues to net leasing costs is misleading. Without leasing, you wouldn't have been able to obtain those gross revenues. And I think that was Tom Dempsey's point from earlier. Leasing affords you with increased opportunities that you wouldn't get without having that tradability. Again, all of these data are essentially, especially for the internal trade stuff, and even tracing trades between MRIs for the external trades, from the between sector trades, that's all self-reported stuff, and we're very appreciative of the industry for putting that stuff together for us and allowing us to tell the story. We do think that the ability to trace will improve, and the estimates are predicated on that lease price model, which doesn't capture true price variation throughout the year, and that's an important thing to note and an important avenue for improvement in the future. So that's all I've got on this today. Thank you.
Thank you, Chad. Great report. I'm going to limit. We're going to take only two questions right now. I'm getting concerned about our time because we have some important issues to cover during the rest of the day. And this is not to diminish the work that you and Drew have done. Are you going to be around during the rest of the day so that people, if they had individual questions that didn't get asked, that they might be able to corner you?
I wouldn't miss today for all the tea in China.
Okay. Thank you very much. I see Tom Dempsey.
You can have my seat. I had a question about the 345 permit holders. It's several times referenced that they're making money on the groundfish leasing revenue, but not fishing. I assume you mean not landing groundfish. I mean, what do we know about those permit holders in terms of their activities in, say, lobster, whatever other fisheries? You know, what do we know about those permit holders in general? Are those primarily retired, inactive fishermen, not tied to boats? Are they people who are leasing out their groundfish for a year or, you know, making that decision annually while they're active in pursuing other fishing opportunities?
It's an excellent question. It's answerable, but not by me and not right now. Well, actually, I shouldn't say not by me. I can answer it, but not right now. The DEMIS data set distinguishes between groundfish trips and non-groundfish trips. And so when those 345 permits are permits that did not make groundfish trips in 2011, that does not mean that they didn't generate any revenue from other fisheries. And I don't know how many of those did just that. But I know that they did not they didn't land any groundfish that year. And so that's something that I can get back to you on.
Anyone else? Dave Gaisel.
Chad, there's an issue with permits in CPH. Could you run through that for the council a little bit and the problems you're having with analyzing them?
This is going to overlap a little bit with Rachel's presentation on Amendment 18 and ownership issues. Hopefully I'm not going to step on anything that she was prepared to say. But when a permit goes into CPH, the permit disappears basically from the permit holder database. There's no need to renew a permit that's not on a SCIF. And so we don't have those CPH permits in our ownership definitions. When we look at the, what Drew is calling the vessel affiliations, and I think what I'm calling ownership groups, it's the same exact thing. We can't trace the CPH permits. I knew this last week, and I can't remember the number off the top of my head, 200 and some odd CPH permits now. I think over 100 of them are enrolled in sectors. Those don't pop up in our ownership group definitions right now. That's a problem that everybody knows about, and the regional office is working on solving. The schema for tracking all of this stuff predates sectors, predates being able to put PSC in CPH into the sector program. It's just a question of catching up administratively, so we'll get there.
And that's a perfect segue into our next item. Rachel? I'm going to turn it over to Terry Stockwell for the groundfish report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Yerman.